Case number 06-1165, American Bird Conservancy, Inc., Appellant versus Federal Communications Commission. Ms. Chavez for the appellant, Mr. Armstrong for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Chavez, and I'm here on behalf of the American Bird Conservancy and the Center for Sustainable Economy. We're here today because the FCC denied and dismissed a petition filed by the groups in 2002 requesting environmental compliance with three applicable statutes. The FCC dismissed the petition for reasons that were both arbitrary and capricious and legally invalid. And I'll go through each of the key aspects.
And what relief would you want? That the court vacate and send it back to the FCC for it to consider all these issues?
Yes, we are asking the court to vacate the order and remand and to make specific findings that the FCC violated the law in specific respects. In particular, the FCC violated...
Well, normally, we would vacate and remand for the FCC to study the issue... to explain its reasoning better, if that's the nature of your objection?
That is not the nature of our objection. In this case, the FCC did not exercise its discretion in the classic sense that an agency does. And so our decision, our appeal is based on the FCC's reasoning that violates NEPA. It's a legally invalid reasoning.
Let me be more direct about what I'm getting at. Isn't the relief that you're seeking what the FCC is already doing in the rulemaking procedures?
No. The rulemaking procedure is essentially a request for comments. The petition, in contrast, was a request for specific actions, a handful of them, granted. The first and central request was a request for the preparation of a programmatic EIS.
Well, one of the requests was a request for an EIS for the 5893 towers that have already been constructed. That's really moot at this point.
Well, that's true, except I need to clarify that that request was for the FCC to redo individual environmental analyses or to do them in the first place for upwards of 5,000 individual towers. The second request, which was entirely separate.
Is that one still?
That was not raised on appeal.
That's not raised. The one about the individuals is not raised on appeal.
The one about, right, there were two requests about individual towers, neither are raised on appeal. The request for a programmatic EIS concerning the cumulative impacts of all towers in the region is raised on appeal, and that is because the FCC's rationale for dismissing that request is based on a legally invalid view of NEPA, essentially.
Can I ask you, before you start into the substance, you said that you have some number of arguments, four or something. It would really help me if you just state the arguments first and then go into the substance of whichever one you
Sure.
Tell me what your four claims that we would have to resolve on this appeal would be.
Okay. First, whether the denial of the request for the programmatic EIS violated NEPA because essentially it shifted the agency's responsibility to carefully consider its actions to the petitioners, requiring the petitioners to demonstrate significance before the agency would agree that it has a responsibility to prepare an EIS. Second, whether the FCC was arbitrary and capricious in dismissing the request for a rulemaking to amend its categorical exclusion regulations, which presently exclude virtually all towers from considering migratory bird effects in violation of the Migratory Bird Act, and also in disregard of several relevant factors. Third, denial of the request for for notice of individual.
I'm sorry, that last one was an individual to amend the categorical exclusion for the, with respect to individual towers.
Are we talking about the third?
Your second claim. The FCC was arbitrary and capricious in dismissing the request for a rulemaking
to eliminate to amend the FCC's categorical exclusion regulations
regarding individual towers. Now you're talking
right
about. Okay,
regarding individual towers.
Uh-huh.
The third was a request. The FCC denied a request for notice of all tower applications, regardless of whether the FCC takes the view that they're categorically excluded. And the dismissal of that request was based on the supposed merits of the present rule, which set up a catch-22 situation where if the petitioners want to receive notice about towers.
Again, skip the substance just for 1 minute. You can come back to it. Okay. That's the third. What's your fourth argument?
And the fourth was the denial of the request for the FCC to initiate programmatic consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service based in order to examine the cumulative effects of towers on endangered species.
And those are the four?
Those are the four.
Thank you.
And unless you have specific questions about one of those, I'll go straight to the denial of the request for programmatic EIS. As I mentioned, the denial was based on the FCC's view that the petitioners themselves must prove, as the FCC said, must prove in this proceeding, being the petition, that the impact of communications towers on migratory birds significantly affects the quality of the human environment, and accordingly that a PEIS, a programmatic EIS, is warranted. This violates NEPA in every way. First of all, it is
violate
the duty.
Violate the FCC regs?
It violates the FCC regs as well, which require, well, I should say that the FCC regs
don't. You don't really talk about the regs too much. And,
the regulations tend to contemplate an environmental analysis of individual towers, and so they don't really govern whether the agency will grant a request for a cumulative programmatic EIS, but under the FCC's regulations.
Well, under the FCC regs, there's a categorical exclusion, but then as to individual towers, you can make an allegation that a particular action will have environmental impact.
Right.
And in doing so, you're supposed to set forth a petition with, in detail, the reasons justifying environmental consideration.
That's correct. And under
why is the order not reflect those regs?
Well, those regulations are actually really not apposite to the order, which was based on the view that the petitioners must prove significance. The regulations require that the petitioners show that a particular action may or will have a significant effect. And so in that sense, the substantive standard of the regulations are very much in play here, in that if the petitioners, and they have, shown that towers cumulatively may or will have a significant effect on migratory birds, then the agency must prepare.
Okay, is that an argument that the categorical exclusion is improper?
No. In a separate context, the petitioners did argue and did petition for a change of those rules based on the fact that the categorical exclusions, as they are written, are improper, are in violation of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, because they exclude virtually all towers from needing at all to consider migratory bird impacts.
But I thought one of your challenges was to amend the categorical exclusion regs, the second one that you listed to Judge Garland.
Right. The petition request was for the agency to amend the categorical exclusion regs, and the agency refused to do so.
And I'm trying to figure out how that's different from your first challenge.
Well, there was a different basis offered by the agency. In the context of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act request, which was the request to amend the regulations, the agency offered a few bases, but most central was the notion that the agency can take some time to further consider whether the Migratory Bird Treaty Act applies to the agency. This was arbitrary and capricious because that question was settled by this court in the Humane Society versus Glickman case in 2000.
Yeah, I guess I'm still focused on NEPA. You have multiple NEPA challenges, correct? Or why don't you tell me what exactly is your NEPA argument?
The most central NEPA argument is that the agency violated NEPA by dismissing the request for a programmatic EIS on the basis of essentially shifting its burden to the petitioners to prove significance.
Okay, if they improperly shifted the burden, the relief you would seek would be to send it back to the FCC for them to analyze it correctly without shifting the burden.
Correct.
And that's what they're doing in the rulemaking.
No, the rulemaking is not a NEPA proceeding. It is not.
It's not?
The rulemaking is a request for comments.
The whole thing's about studying the NEPA requirements with respect to the effect of towers on migratory birds. Not the whole thing. That's a central part of the rulemaking, I thought. Is that not right?
Well, the entire rulemaking.
And aren't you participating in the rulemaking procedures?
I'm sorry?
You're participating in the rulemaking, correct?
Our clients are participating in the rulemaking proceedings by submitting comments. The entire rulemaking is a request for comments. At best, it asks whether the FCC should take action to protect birds, but the entire thing is a request for comments, which does not.
Let me just ask about that. Sure. I understand your conceptual point, I think, that you emphasize in your brief, but I want to be clear. In the notice of proposed rulemaking, there's a lot that I would characterize as a notice of further inquiry. But there is also a proposal saying they want comments on whether they should amend the rules with regard to newly constructed or modified towers to comply with these lighting specifications. Why is that not the type of thing you want done here?
Well, that would be among the type of things that would need to be considered in a programmatic EIS. But standing alone, and even the entire rulemaking, the so-called notice of proposed rulemaking, standing alone falls far short of what was required under NEPA, which is a careful consideration of the effects of the agency's program, which would require examination of many, many other issues aside from simply whether it's
ignore for a moment, if you will, the delay. What I simply want to understand that if the agency has had proceeded in what you consider to be the proper manner, I gather you agree that it could proceed by a notice of inquiry, then an examination of the comments, and then either a further request for comments and a proposal that, well, what about lighting? What about some other things?
Correct. The short answer is that is correct, that the agency could have looked at the information before it and based on that information determined whether towers cumulatively may or will have a significant effect.
Well, the agency said we have some evidence, but we're going to have a consultant help us out. And so the consultant looks at it and comes up with some statements and then says, but, you know, some further study is needed. Ignore the delay problem here. What's wrong with the agency proceeding that way?
Actually, Your Honor, delay here is not a part of the problem at all because it's the substance of what the agency has done that falls short.
And I want to understand specifically what has the agency done that violates one of these, three statutes and your notice argument.
The agency, whether it was the consultant or the agency itself, neither have ever undertaken the analysis of whether towers may or will significantly affect the human environment and therefore require preparation of an EIS.
And you're saying that the agency had to do that before
it
gathered information either through consultants or comments?
We're saying the agency had to do that before it dismissed the petition to prepare an EIS. Before it refused to prepare an EIS, it had to first either determine that there will not be any significant impacts, in which case it would have been required to prepare a finding of no significant impacts under NEPA.
Is there, in the other proceeding, is the issue of whether to prepare a EIS still live?
I am not sure if it's phrased that way, but I am fairly confident there is some request for information on whether further consideration of the issue is warranted. So
whether of this specific issue of whether there should be a programmatic EIS, right?
you know, I'm not certain if it was.
We can ask the other side. I had the impression that that was included. I understand that the reason you're not happy to just let that go forward is that you have no reason to believe they would apply a different standard, that is, who they would put the burden of on, than they put in this proceeding.
That's right? Correct.
You would at least like us to say, even if they proceed in the other proceeding, that they can only do that if they understand that the rule is that the burden is not on the plaintiff to show or to prove significant effect, but where there's uncertainty or whatever the correct standard is, the purpose of a PEIS is to find out whether or not there is a significant impact, right?
That is right.
I don't understand actually why no one's addressed the question of whether this is programmatic. That is, and I appreciate this isn't raised by either party, but it doesn't, on the face of it, it's not clear there is a program here. And I'm trying to remember what the name of the Supreme Court's opinion on this is. But these which I'll find in a second. But it's not so clear to me that there is a program here. That is, that all these different towers are tied together in some way, that the approval of the towers all together is part of a program.
Well, you're correct in that the issue of whether there's a program has not been raised. The same set of NEPA, it's the same set of FCC regulations govern every tower licensing decision.
I think it's CLEPI. Yeah.
Right. And with respect to CLEPI, the counsel for the FCC has raised CLEPI. CLEPI is entirely an apposite here. In CLEPI, there was an EIS performed, and the plaintiff simply thought that the geographic scope of the EIS should have been larger. Here, the agency has refused to acknowledge that an EIS must be performed on legally invalid grounds. So CLEPI is premature at best.
All right, if I understand the interchange we just had, there's not a delay issue that concerns you whether this is decided in this proceeding or in the next, but you're concerned that whichever proceeding it's done in, the agency has to proceed with the correct burden of proof, essentially, or standard of review, or what the threshold is, or however we use those words. Is that right?
That's right, but also that the agency needs to actually undertake action, the kind of analysis that complies with NEPA, and we're concerned that the notice of inquiry and the notice of proposed rulemaking are not the type of analyses that are required under NEPA.
That's what I was trying to get at here, and that's what I meant by delay. I mean, they put out a notice and they get all this, then they have a consultant says, well, we need more study. I mean, time is passing. What I'm trying to understand is if they had done precisely what you think was correct, all right, and understood it was their obligation, not yours, what would they have done differently? Now, part of it, I gather, is you think they should have looked at the studies that the Fish and Wildlife Service have done over the years, and there was other information available to them, and they should have made a preliminary determination, at least, and that asking all these questions is really irrelevant to that?
That asking all of these questions is premature because the agency has not done its own analysis yet to determine whether there may be significance. If it had done what it was supposed to do, the agency would have looked at all the information before it and asked itself the question, will or may our towers cumulatively significantly affect the environment? And if they determined that it will or may, then they would have moved on to an EIS. At the end of, some of the procedure is up to the agency's discretion, and we recognize that, but what the agency is doing right now is entirely outside of the NEPA context and is being offered as a reason to delay and avoid compliance with NEPA. And so that's what we are concerned about. It's not simply the time delay.
Well, isn't the agency analyzing the law and the facts to determine whether it's required to prepare an EIS with respect to towers?
Well, the agency is certainly entitled to analyze the facts to determine whether it's required to prepare an EIS, but it is not at liberty to interpret NEPA in such a way that would undermine NEPA.
Right. Well, when I say law, I suppose I mean whether there should still be a categorical exclusion. Isn't that part of the rulemaking question?
Well, it is. However, it's not part of the decision whether to prepare a programmatic EIS. Those issues should not have been entwined at any point. The decision whether to prepare a programmatic EIS should not be upheld or should not be held up based on the desire to determine whether or not to change the agency's categorical rules, because those can be entirely separated. And they are entirely separate issues.
The argument about delegation with respect to the NEPA, is that part of this argument?
Only to the extent that the agency, and I think this is mostly a post hoc argument, but only to the extent that the agency offers as a basis for its decision for dismissing the petition the fact that it has.
When you say it's a post hoc argument, you mean post hoc by you?
No, post hoc by counsel for the
agency.
Did
you raise the argument about unlawful delegation before?
Well, we raised the argument in response to the FCC's justification for dismissing the petition.
Raise the argument here.
Right.
Or did you raise it in the agency?
Yes. Well, the petition was in part based on the fact that by operation of this total delegation to individual tower owners, migratory birds are not considered. And so that was a basis for the petition, but the petition did not attack that directly. The petition asked the FCC to change its approach. By pointing to its existing approach, the FCC has attempted to justify the dismissal of the petition. So only in that sense is that an issue here. But we're not challenging the delegation practice directly on appeal. It's simply a rebuttal to their justification.
I'm not clear about that. Because I thought the briefs addressed that.
I'm sorry, address?
I thought the briefs addressed that question.
There's two delegation arguments.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why I'm confused. One, I guess, is the ESA delegation, and one is the NEPA. You're saying with respect to NEPA, you're not challenging the way in which the agency delegates NEPA considerations to the towers?
No, because that only arises in the context of individual tower licensing decisions, which have not been raised on appeal.
Part of the programmatic one.
Right.
I see.
But it is part of the notice issue.
It is. It's part of the notice as well as the ESA.
In other words, just so I'm clear, the petition is not challenging the fact that the agency could permissibly delegate certain decision making to the tower owners.
That is correct.
But that the manner in which it has been done here undermines, just to put it in a nutshell, the purposes of NEPA, say.
Right.
Is that the nature of the argument?
The nature of the argument, the basis for the petition was that the FCC's practice of allowing tower owners alone to determine whether an EA will be prepared undermines NEPA.
But since you're only, now I think maybe I understand what I didn't understand before, but since on appeal you're only raising the programmatic issue, there's no claim by the other side really that there's a delegation to all towers to get together and answer the programmatic problem.
That's right.
So that's not really an issue on this claim.
That's correct.
Okay, got it. All right, can you talk about the second claim?
Sure. Actually, we've gone through it quite extensively with Judge Kavanaugh's questioning. Unless there are any further questions on that, I'll go on
reason,
to.
Just to, I understand what, with respect to that one, is that issue also raised in the other proceeding?
I'm sorry. Was that issue raised?
Is it also at issue in the other proceeding? That is the possibility of amending the categorical exclusion. Is that?
Yes.
That is at issue in the other proceeding.
The agency has asked for public comment on whether it should amend its categorical exclusions, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. Then you can go on to the third.
In the context of dismissing the petition, however, the agency simply offered as basis for its dismissal that it was questioning whether the MBTA applies to the agency, and that was an arbitrary and capricious basis for dismissing the petition. That had real effects, even if the question is being considered in the future and might be addressed by the agency in the future, for those towers that for the last year have been licensed and for all the species that have been affected, that was a final decision that has affected the petitioners. And so it was improper and arbitrary and capricious to defer or dismiss or deny that request on the invalid basis that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act might not apply to the agency. If there are no further questions.
Their argument only that it doesn't apply to the agency or that it doesn't apply to non-intentional kills?
Both.
Both.
That.
The first argument we've already taken care of in a previous opinion. The second argument, as far as I know, the circuit hasn't decided, right?
As far as I know, the circuit hasn't decided. It's been decided. There's a case that's fairly on point in out of the District of Colorado in 1999, the Moon Lake case, which held that there are no exceptions in Section 703 of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act for inadvertent or unintentional takings. That, in that case, it was an electrical co-op that was being sued for electric towers that were causing the takings of migratory birds. And on essentially,
I remember. I remember the case. Okay,
okay.
Thank you.
All right. Do you want to save your time?
Oh, sure. I will be happy to.
Can I just ask one
sure.
last question? On the notice issue, the thing that I'm a little confused about with respect to that is they do have a website on which applications are announced, correct?
It's my understanding that applications are not announced before the registration is granted. The applications are uploaded. Again, this is my understanding. Applications are made online, but the public and the petitioners do not receive notice that might say, for example, this tower owner has applied for a registration.
Sure. If it were posted, would that satisfy your notice?
Notice of individual towers.
Or just posted on the website, that would be.
Well, you'd only be satisfied, would you not, if you had sufficient time
the notice must actually foster participation in the NEPA process, and so if it happened the day before the authorization was granted and there was no opportunity for notice and comment, it would be pointless. But what the petitioners are seeking here is an opportunity to challenge the assertion that a tower is categorically excluded.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. Context is critical. This case was decided by applying rules which the commission sent to the Council on Environmental Quality, and the council gave its approval to those rules, and nobody filed a timely challenge for judicial review. Now, under the rules that existed before these rules, when the commission first sought to implement its responsibilities under the environmental statutes.
When were these rules?
These were in 86, and the first ones were in 74. The rules in 74 required applicants to submit a narrative statement comprehensively discussing environmental effects. For those 12 years, those statements would include some discussion of migratory birds. The Council on Environmental Quality put out regulations which allowed agencies to distinguish, to have categorically excluded actions, to have certain effects that were not categorically excluded and would routinely have to be considered, to have other effects placed in a categorically excluded, subject to a safety valve classification.
Can I just ask you, in the second proceeding here, the commission has gone on to propose an amendment, all right, that would take some of these towers out of these categorical exclusions.
Judge Rogers, that's critical to my point. I have a twofold point here. That the first thing is we properly adjudicated this petition under the CEQ-approved rules allowing for a categorical exclusion.
I know, but the petitioner's argument is that the rules don't amend the statute here, and they're saying that the agency has just misconstrued the statute.
The place to have said that the categorical exclusion is a violation of the statute presumably would have been first at CEQ in 86, when CEQ was asked to approve our rules, putting migratory birds in the categorically excluded slash safety valve category, because there's always a chance, even in a categorical exclusion.
But my point, Mr. Armstrong, is that the agency itself isn't taking that position.
But my point, Judge Rogers, is the place to change rules and take them out of categorical exclusion is in a rulemaking. And that's what the commission is proposing to do. We certainly do not contend. Perhaps, I will even concede, perhaps had there been a timely challenge in 86, the commission would have been found to have made a mistake in the way it treated migratory birds. And even if it didn't make a mistake in the initial decision to put them in the categorical exclusion, perhaps as a result of subsequent developments, not doing something to
So if an agency dismisses a petition on the ground that the petitioner has failed to meet its burden, when Supreme Court, this court, have held that the burden is on the agency, there's no remedy available?
Well, there was no contemporaneous judicial review of whether we had failed to meet our statutory burden when we put them in the categorically excluded category. If CEQ approved them and there was no timely judicial review, we take the position.
Well, we have case law on exactly this subject.
Yes.
I'm surprised if this is the argument you're going to make that you don't cite it. My recollection of it is that if the argument is a procedural attack on the rule, that is, it wasn't attacked in time, then it's sort of too late, or there wasn't a notice and comment or something, it's too late. But if the argument is that the rule is in direct violation of a federal statute, the rule doesn't stand just because nobody applied it before when you're actually applying it to a specific case. Am I wrong about that characterization?
Well, my understanding is that obviously if a rule violates the statute, the rule can't be applied. Our argument is that, however, that we have to believe it was a good faith attempt in 86 to adopt a rule which we thought complied with the statute. And we certainly went to the CEQ for guidance to determine whether we were in compliance with the statute.
But I don't think
And sure
we thought
matters.
From the fact that we got that approval that we were in compliance with the statute. And you don't, if you have the categorical exclusion.
What if the facts change? Suppose the facts change since 86 and now migratory birds are known to be a problem, and so they're challenging the regulation that categorically excludes towers on the ground that the categorical exclusion's no longer consistent with NEPA.
Well, we believe, first, Judge Kavanaugh, that the commission should be given an opportunity in its rulemaking.
Okay, that's a separate argument.
To state whether or not it believes that the categorical exclusion complies with NEPA. And that is a better forum in which that issue can be litigated.
That
I would
well
certainly
be,
agree.
But I'd like to be clear on the first point, the grounds on which the commission dismissed the original petition. All right. Is it your position that there was no error of law in interpreting that the petitioners had the burden?
Judge Rogers, it is our position that until and unless someone believes that the categorical exclusion of migratory birds violates the law, it was appropriate through the safety valve provision to put the burden on the petitioners under the present legal rules, which we believe are in compliance with NEPA.
All right, that's your answer. Got it.
Can you say something about the notice question? So you say there is notice, they say there isn't notice. And I'm confused.
Well,
is there notice or isn't there notice?
If it's a environmental considerations can come up in two ways.
Well,
if it's for the tower registration.
Right. So somebody wants to build a tower. They make an application. Is it on a website?
A tower registration application, as I understand it, is not on the website at the present
time. So there isn't notice in advance.
That is correct.
So now, the government's argument, the FCC said below that there was notice. And that's just wrong?
I'm not immediately aware of the statement that was made.
I thought that was part of their...
I think we said we gave notice wherever we were required to do so.
There's a statement in paragraph in paragraph 17, there's a statement that petitioners failed to demonstrate that each tower could not be reviewed on an individual basis.
Well.
And it does seem to me that if it's not posted and they don't otherwise get notice, that right. they have demonstrated.
And in 18, it says, the rules don't require the kind of personal notice that petitioners appear to request. Well, they're not asking for personal notice. They're just asking for notice on a website, and it doesn't appear that even get non-personal notice.
Let me try just a minute to go back to the regime that we sought to invoke when we went to CEQ with these rules. CEQ told us when we have a categorical exclusion, we must have the safety valve opportunity for people to make a showing. CEQ, and we've coordinated all of our notice and public participation.
Well, it's always too late, though. It's always too late to have.
But Judge Kavanaugh, if I respectfully submit, the problem is not as severe as it might first appear. I understand what you're saying, and I will.
That may be, but I'm just trying to
get. Can we just get the facts?
Just for purposes of informing.
Mr. Armstrong, one second. Just one second. On the fact question I asked you.
Is there notice on the website? I will ask for permission to substitute a correction if my people tell me that I'm wrong. But it's my understanding that unless an environmental assessment is prepared for some other reason, for example, mm-hmm. endangered species, mm-hmm. if there's an environmental assessment, there will be notice because that's put on public notice and there's an opportunity for a 30-day comment period. As a practical matter, people can find out about towers, but they don't do it from the FCC. They do it from local zoning proceedings. It's conceivable it could happen as a result of proceedings before the FAA. It's conceivable it could happen as a matter of proceedings in the National Historic Preservation process. Typically, it's local zoning. But if you didn't have notice from a local zoning proceeding, and if you didn't have an environmental assessment at the FCC and nothing from these other entities. It is true that at the tower registration stage, there would not be notice. Now, we've coordinated those procedures with the CEQ, trying to make sure that we allow for public participation on environmental matters, and we have not been advised by CEQ that our present procedures are unlawful.
Don't you think it makes it somewhat hollow to allow the safety valve if you don't have the notice that would allow you to take advantage of the safety valve?
Judge Kavanaugh, let me answer your question this way. It would not have surprised me that in devising the environmental framework, a requirement for the safety valve would have been accompanied by a requirement to make the world safe for safety valve filings by giving notice. But so far as I know, that has not been required by CEQ.
So, okay.
In insisting on or in asking the court to respect the agency's decision to tackle the continuing legitimacy of the categorical exclusion for migratory birds in a rulemaking, and in respecting the agency's ability to go forward under its existing rules, pending the completion of that rulemaking, we certainly understand our responsibility to defend the conduct of the rulemaking. And Judge Rogers, you alluded to this, I think, when you spoke about delay.
Well, they say they're not raising that, so we don't need to discuss that.
But, well, on the fish and wildlife point, I think it's certainly fair to say that the Fish and Wildlife Service, in the migratory birds context and in the rulemaking context, has certainly indicated that it is supportive of some changes in the Commission's approach to migratory birds. But I would call the Court's attention to the fact that the Department of Justice is on our brief in this particular case, in which we're defending the way we adjudicated this petition. And the Department of Justice, among its other clients, does represent the Fish and Wildlife Service. Insofar as the delegation point has come up, which I believe has come up in connection with the Endangered Species Act and the Fish and Wildlife Service, the regulations of the Fish and Wildlife Service allow the Commission to designate the applicants as non-federal representatives for purposes of informally consulting with the Fish and Wildlife Service to determine whether formal consultation is required. So that's a permissible delegation. Now there's another.
Do you agree that they have to have at least an informal consultation?
Judge Garland, as I understand it from talking to our staff, the answer, there is a certification that can be filed on a tower registration application in which the applicant certifies that required.
I'm going to ask you about the certification, but before we get to that, do you
it's
agree?
It's related to your question, though, on the
I know, I know. That's the way in which it occurs. But my first question is, you agree there has to be at least informal consultation?
Well, it's my understanding that if they get a qualified biologist to tell the applicant that there will be no impact on endangered species, it's my understanding from our processing staff, that under those circumstances, it might be possible not to go to Fish and Wildlife Service. Generally, as I understand it, they do go to Fish and Wildlife Service. If there are, they can do three things. The first, they can look for documentation to establish that there are simply no endangered species in the vicinity.
I know.
Second thing they can do, I mentioned, was the qualified biologist saying, yes, there are endangered
species. Let's be clear, in this record, the Fish and Wildlife Service has been asking for the Commission to consult with it, and the Fish and Wildlife keep putting out all this documentation about these harms to endangered
Judge
species.
Judge Rogers, I think it's important to...
I mean, that's the record.
I believe there's a distinction between the Fish and Wildlife Service supporting some changes in regard to migratory birds in the rulemaking, and the Fish and Wildlife Service's discussions with the Commission under the present rules dealing with endangered species and consultation and the consultation process.
Can you tell me where in the JA the applicant is told that they have to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service, even informally? Where on the application, which starts at page JA 494?
Judge Garland, I request the right to amend my answer, but it's my understanding we give people a checklist in which they are told what they are expected to do in order to put themselves to the position of certifying. If there is no environmental assessment, they are supposed to follow certain steps to assure the accuracy of the certification that there no environmental assessment is required. There's a checklist. I would be happy to, I may not be in the joint appendix, I would be happy to supply that for the court.
That'd be great. Thanks.
I think to summarize it just very quickly, though, what you're going to find is that if there's a certification of no need for an environmental assessment on an endangered species matter, what you're going to, I believe what you're going to find is that you're supposed to do three things. One of three things, or some combination of three things, before you can make that certification. First thing is you get documentation of no endangered species. Second thing is you get an opinion from a qualified biologist of no impact. If you don't have that qualified biologist saying no impact, and there are endangered species in the area, then you are obliged to go to Fish and Wildlife Service.
I'll wait
and have
to look at
informal
the checklist.
Consultation.
Thanks.
If there are no further questions, we will rest on our brief and ask the court to defend the commission's adjudication of this petition.
Can I just ask you one other thing? What's the status of this notice of proposed rulemaking?
That's what I wanted to speak to Judge Rogers a minute ago, and you told me I didn't have to, but I welcome the chance to do so.
Well, let me clarify my point so you're clear, Mr. Armstrong. What I said is petitioners were not raising a delay argument. My question is, the commission put out a notice of proposed rulemaking. What is the status of it?
It was put out in November a year ago. We've received, in addition to many, many just citizen letters, if you really talk about substantive pleadings, we received something like 140 to 150. The pleading deadline closed in less than 4 months ago after a request for an extension of the deadline for filing comments and reply comments, a request, by the way, in which the environmental petitioners and the industry joined. So the record has been complete with 100, it's a big record with 140.
So the staff is reviewing the comments?
And the staff is now reviewing these pleadings that have been submitted.
Has the staff given the commission any expectation of when the commission can receive its recommendation?
The staff has not either volunteered a date for submitting the recommendation, nor have they been asked at this point to supply the chairman with the
thank you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel for petitioner.
Your Honor, I'd like to just cover a few points that were raised by counsel. First, counsel suggests that the petitioners cannot now challenge in any way the categorical exclusions. Well, the petitioners saw the problem with the categorical exclusions, and that is that back in 1984 or 86 when they were adopted, the FCC never considered whether those categorical exclusions, never considered migratory bird impacts in adopting its categorical exclusions. Hence, they requested the FCC to amend its categorical exclusions. And this court has made clear that although perhaps an original rule cannot be challenged, where a plaintiff has filed a petition for rulemaking, the court certainly has jurisdiction to review the dismissal of that petition for rulemaking, and that's the posture that we're in here. In the context of reviewing that decision, the agency is owed no special deference in this case, as this court said in Professional Pilots case 1997, where the decision not to institute rulemaking is based on the supposed merits of the existing rule. The agency is owed no special deference. Now, with respect to the Fish and Wildlife Service, it is a bit misleading to suggest that the Fish and Wildlife simply supports changes in the agency's program. The director in 1999, and this is in the record at JA 21 to 22, director of the Fish and Wildlife Service in 1999 wrote a letter to the FCC saying, essentially, for the last 3 years, we have been trying to get you to do things differently. You are still allowing tower owners to certify without any oversight by the agency that towers have no effects. Please do a programmatic EIS because the effects are cumulative and significant. Again, in 2000, there's a similar letter at JA 122, and a 1999 Fish and Wildlife paper estimated as many as 40 million birds killed per year. If this is not clear evidence that the towers may cumulatively affect birds, I'm not sure what it is. The Fish and Wildlife Service is the agency charged with the primary duty to protect these animals. So if the Fish and Wildlife Service believes that the impacts are significant enough, then that should have been enough. Finally, with respect to the certification process, it's not enough that the agency could, if it chose, exercise some oversight over this procedure. In practice, although there is a checklist explaining to tower owners when they need to prepare an EA, In practice, all the FCC does is require the tower owners to check a box that says yes or no, check here. Will this tower have significant effects and therefore require preparation of an EA? The tower owner checks no, and the FCC does not review that assertion because there's no basis for reviewing that assertion. There's no documentation required, and there's simply no basis for even reviewing it. The FCC doesn't ever review those. When individual towers actually make it through some kind of environmental consideration process, it's by the accident of someone, maybe through a local zoning hearing, catching wind of the tower. But that is not evidence that the program as it exists is working. Where there are something like 90,000 towers existing in the country, three examples don't show that the system is working. So the problem with certification is that is a total delegation. If there are no more questions.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until Friday morning at 9:30 a.m.
Hey, Joe, it's Amy. Do you have Sylvia's extension? No, that's Mary. Thanks, bye. Who should I call? Because somebody keeps setting an alarm off. Yeah, they don't use their key card, so when they walk out, they just walk out. They're supposed to use their key card. And this had happened earlier, and Shane had called somebody, but I don't know who she called. I tried calling Mary, no answer. Sylvia, no answer. Yeah. Oh, somebody has to come. I don't know if it's a marshal that has to come up and reset it, but we have to call, somebody has to come up and actually turn it off. Okay, thanks.